From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. Got a little what I like to call Bob on Bob action today. I'm joined by my good friend, Bob Mata. I can tell you what, I don't even know where this thing is going. Our patrons already got 20 minutes of pre-show yapping about everything from not drinking to the cases I don't know about. So I asked Bob to come on. Bob is one of those justice warriors that is working hard every day, all over the map when it comes to the criminal justice system. He's an attorney. He's a podcaster. He's a YouTuber. What's up, Bob?
What is up, my friend? I always love hanging with you. I was glad you hit me up. I was thinking about you. I think a day prior, your ears must have been burning or ringing, whichever.
That's what happened.
Yeah. I mean, and then you hit me up and I'm like, yo, I'm living the dream, you know, working really hard between the YouTube thing and the podcast. It's a lot. You know, it's a lot, but I enjoy
it. It keeps you busy.
It does.
And actually, this is good time. So this is going to drop on the 19th, and I'm going to be on Bob's show. If you want more Bob on Bob action, I'm going to be on the Defense Diaries YouTube channel or Instagram. Where are you? Do you stream it all over the place, or is it just on the YouTube?
Yeah, no, I usually do it to YouTube and Twitter, you know, so like I'll be streaming on both those things, but I always am live, you know what I mean?
So yeah.
I actually want to get to the point where I'm making videos. I know somebody who's real adept at editing, though, because that's not me. It's not. Right. Man, it's not one of the things I'm good at. It's like I could put together like a short, especially with StreamYard, because now you can clip stuff and
right.
See what the robot does it for you, and you can tinker with it a bit. But yeah, man, just keeping busy. There's always, you know, crime never sleeps. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
There's always cases.
So many cases. Yeah. And you keep up with all of them. And that conversation, I'm going to be on Bob's show, will be live streaming on Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Central Time. For a lot of you guys, that's normally when we're doing our follow-up episode. So you guys are used to streaming that time. This week for the follow-up for this episode is actually going to be tomorrow night. It'll be on Monday, because Janet has another obligation. So we're going to be doing our follow-up stream Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern. And then on Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern, I'll be on Bob's channel. So if you want to check out that stream.
Yeah, and I'm excited about that, man. I just recently got caught up on season 17, you know, because we have mutual friends, obviously, with Dr. Nikki Jackson and then obviously Michael Osbrook. And, you know, I know that was a case that they really... We're excited that you were covering, because that was a case that's near and dear to both of them in terms of the amount of work that they've done on those. So I'm anxious to hear. I think I'm on episode 11. So I've still got a little bit to go. Actually, I just finished you going through Faust's first statement. So I think that's episode 10, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember what episode number it is, but yeah, looking forward to talking about that. And actually, just remind, I was just thinking how close you are in Chicago. I forgot that from our season 12 case, because the Innocence Conference is in Chicago over near you this weekend.
I was just whining to a couple of my friends in the Innocence Project that I slept on getting tickets, and I'm trying to weasel my way in because I want to get there. Yeah, it's actually this weekend, you know?
Yeah, I didn't realize it was, I got a message yesterday from some attorneys that work for our season 12 case, our Pinyon Pines case out in California, that, you know, they said, hey, we're kind of close. Can we get together this weekend? I don't know if I'm gonna be able to arrange it or not, but I was like, oh shit, I didn't even know the conference was this weekend or that it was so close to me. So yeah, let me know if you end up making it in. I'm curious. I usually don't go because it's so far away, you know, it's in Texas or it's somewhere far away, but it's right around the lake now.
Coming in? Are you gonna?
No, I don't. I mean, I may, I'll let you know. I may end up coming in tomorrow. I totally spaced it actually. So we're Bob and I recording this on Saturday the 11th. Yeah, I kind of spaced that. They sent me that message last night or yesterday afternoon. So I may tomorrow on Sunday try to make a trip in if that's going to work out.
Yeah, well,
but it's kind of like you said, we're actually got some nice weather. I also have a lot of yard work to do.
I do. I'm looking out my window and it's not pretty. Like I've got this giant pin oak that every year my guys who handle my landscaping, usually at least like mowing the lawn and like the fall cleanup shit, It's a huge pin oak, and it's the last tree to drop. And these guys, like 3 years in a row, I keep fucking telling these guys, I'm like, look, man, I'm like, you guys are doing the fall clean too early because that tree drops and it covers, like, and I've got a relatively big lot, and I'm like, it's covering like 100 yards of shit with leaves, and it's killing my grass because you guys don't come back and get it. So yeah, that's what I'm looking at out there now, and it, like, it just infuriates me every year. Like, but I gotta fire these dudes and get some dude, like some dudes that understand the concept. You gotta wait till all the shit drops. That's the whole point.
You might have to put a rake in your hands, Bob, and go out there and
I'm doing it. I'm getting my 18-year-old's coming out and helping me. I gave her no choice in the matter. So
nice.
Yeah, you're coming out to help me rake.
All right, well, let's get into it. We got a lot of stuff. We talked about one of the cases. I just at least wanted an overview on because you covered this one. We had talked about covering the Faust case, talked about covering the Barton McNeil case, which is one you've got some work coming up on.
Yep.
We've had you on before talking about the Beverly case from the Songbird Lane case. And in our chat right now is going wild, telling you to tell me about Aaron Spencer's case, which I'm not familiar with. So first and foremost, the one that I was wanting to hear about because everybody was asking me questions about it a couple months ago, and I didn't know anything about it, was the Edric Faust case.
Yep.
I've since done a little reading on it, and from what you can read about it, it just seems like a pretty obvious case of guilt, but there's so many people that seem to think that Faust is innocent or that he didn't get a fair trial. Kind of give me your take. I guess give us a quick rundown of the basics of the case and what your thoughts on it and how you feel about the folks that are either didn't get a fair trial or feel that he's innocent.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of the case either. And I guess a podcast had been done about it after, I think, about 23 years. And it kind of like shined a light back on the case. And it kind of got the, you know, cold case division down there in Georgia, the TBI, the GBI too. Yeah, see, that's like I've been covering the Zach Adams thing. So I'm in Tennessee Bureau of Investigation World.
Yeah.
But at any rate, you know, the GBI, their cold case division picks it up again. There was some DNA, obviously, the advancements in DNA testing and the ability to be able to get samples and provide profiles from minuscule amounts of DNA now exist where it didn't back then. And so at any rate, this is kind of the background. It was Tara Baker. She was 23 years old. She was going to University of Georgia, Athens. Back in 2001, sometime overnight or in the early morning hours, depends on who you ask, on the 18th or 19th of January, she was stabbed in the neck. She was strangled with a printer cord and she was sexually assaulted. All in her own apartment, and then her apartment was set on fire. Mm-hmm. Case goes cold for 23 years. There's no suspect, there's no arrest, nothing. And then in 2023, Georgia passed this Coleman-Baker Act, partly named because of Tara, and that created a cold case unit with the GBI, and they got some funding. And, you know, with that funding, they also got some modern DNA tech that they could play with. So at that point in May of 2024, after they create a profile, they run it through CODIS, they get a hit. And it turns out to be this Edric Faust guy. And they arrest him immediately and he's charged with 12 felonies.
He was never on their radar as a suspect prior to this.
Not mentioned in one report. Like, he was not anybody that was even spoken of, thought of in any capacity. So this guy was completely off the radar. So then he goes to trial, and I'm just giving you like the overview.
Yeah.
Back in February, mid-February, he gets convicted of all 12 counts. He's sentenced to 2 consecutive life sentences plus 45 years. And here's the issue with the case. As you noted, in terms of the evidence, not strong in terms of forensic evidence from the scene. They actually have zero connecting him to being in that house. Like, there's nothing that they found that puts him in that house. However, when they did the 23-year-old rape kit is what they used to pull the profile off of, that's where they get the match. So the DNA is where this case lives. And my friend, she's got a YouTube channel. She's great. She has a real knack for finding cases that are fascinating and troublesome in the same breath. Her name's Kat Knott Williams. She was covering this and everybody was screaming like they do with you. You know, hey, you need to look at this case. You need to look at this case. So I kind of jumped in mid-trial and I started watching it. And it became pretty evident to me as soon as I heard the words true allele. And Bob, I don't know if you've ever handled a case with that company being involved from the state side of it. It's software created by this company called Cybergenetics, and it's problematic. Alice and I had run up against these guys in our Garcia case back in 2016, and we fought to keep them out, you know, because we were like, look, this is just black box algorithm, single data point shit. It's, you know, garbage in, garbage out. They can't prove that it works. We don't know if it's reliable or not. It can't be tested. It hasn't been tested. So in that case, in Garcia, we were able to keep it out, but the judge gave us like an ultimatum that if we had our guy who is, you know, a pretty renowned DNA guy, Dr. Carl Reich, who had said in our case that unequivocally that this mixed sample that they had found on the doorknob of a different doctor who they had claimed in part of their narrative that our client had tried to go over to their house to kill her first and that he left his DNA on there. When they pulled it and ran it through their lab, it was like a 1 in 12. It was garbage. It was like that could be, you know, anybody on the jury. One of the 12 people on the jury also could not be excluded. So it was like I wasn't worried about it. So then during the pendency, they went and found true allele, and true allele came back with the 1 in like 8 quadrillion or so, you know, some insane number that basically like, okay, well, Tim, you know, with no basis in science and no ability for Reich to be able to say, okay, well, I need to see how you got to this. How does your algorithm work? Like, what is the program? And Mark Perlin, who owns that company, is one of the co-founders, is like, nah. He's like, it's proprietary. He's like, I'm not going to give that up. That destroys the value of the company. So essentially, you're stuck with the situation where you can't test their work. You can't check their homework. It's like, it's like the ultimate trust me, bro shit like that you'll ever see. It's terrifying. It absolutely. So as soon as I heard that True Allele was involved and that it was coming in, I'm like, he's done. I'm like, I don't know what the number is, but it's going to be massive. It's going to be 1 in 800 quadrillion. Which
did you say they're using some kind of out? They're not actually like drawing, the alleles out of it to seeing how they match up. That's using some kind of like, predictive algorithm type of thing. Because that's when I was reading about it, I was like, okay, everybody's talking about Edric Faust. I know that Bob worked on it some. I'm going to have him on. So I started reading about it, and I'm like, well, this is a bull. They found his DNA on her. Like, what are we talking about here? But so maybe not that simple.
No, it's not that simple. And so basically what true, like what they call it is it's probabilistic genotyping is what it is. So what that means is it takes a sample of degraded mixed profiles, meaning that there's multiple contributors, right? So this isn't like they're pulling off one sample and it's just one person's DNA. It's like that thing where you have multiple people that left DNA, so you're pulling a mixed sample, and the software uses an algorithm to try to mathematically separate the profiles. So it's done completely differently than we're used to in terms of creating a profile, and then you're looking at the loci and, you know, the peak alleles and all that shit. That doesn't go on with this. Like I said, it literally just prints out like a little pulled it, rip it off, and like, oh, there you go. You know, it is ultimate trust me, bro. Shit. Like,
and the FBI is accepting that because obviously in this case they must have run it through CODIS, right, to find Faust.
They did. They're like, so yeah, which is a real problem for me. You know, because at least with CODIS, in terms of what they'll even put in terms of CODIS, it's got to have.
Yeah, they're really restrictive.
Super restrictive. I think what they were able to do is just go in, they find this match, and ultimately the judge lets it in because they fought to keep it out, you know? And like, my thing is that the problem with true allele is it's being allowed in courts, like around the country. And the bigger problem is that even though in Fry or Daubert hearings, whichever the state is still using, whichever one of those two it's using in terms of trying to determine the reliability of the science, for some reason they're not able to do it, but they're still allowing it in. Like, they've allowed it in California, New York State has allowed it in. So it's coming, and there's gotten, like, it's a terrifying prospect. Like, I'm hoping that the defense bar is going to start mounting a much more stiff defense to this, because it's scary. It really is something that where you can't see the work. You don't know how they're reaching it. You don't know how this thing works. And again, it's this proprietary algorithm that the courts are not forcing him to turn over. So, you know, the way that they call it, it's like, it's this MATLAB. It's a trade secret. It's like the Coke recipe, you know, for Coca-Cola. Like, they never give it up. It's the same shit. Nobody gets it. So the government crime labs don't get it in terms of the, you know, what the source code is. Defense experts don't get it. So, like, my guy didn't get it. No one gets it. And like, the peer review articles, they've shown that everybody that they've had to try to peer review true allele are all people that have some kind of vested interest in true allele. There's something really, really scary about it. So I don't trust it at all. And you know, so you take that and you kind of put it to the side. But I told everybody that was watching that case, I'm like, he's going to get convicted, because it produces a number that jurors cannot ignore, and they won't ignore.
Yeah.
And then as I was watching that trial, the defense was definitely hamstrung by Judge Lott. She was incredibly biased. I think he's going to get a new trial, because she was incredibly biased. She made some really bad rulings. I do not think that he got a fair trial. Let me say that right out front. You know, but I have the same questions that you do. I'm like, if it's his DNA, we've got a problem in terms of if we're talking about actual innocence here. I mean, I think he unequivocally didn't get a fair trial. I'm not as quick to jump on the bandwagon of he didn't do it. I don't think that he did, but I can see a world in which he did, because his DNA prospectively was found in her, you know, because they did swabs, they did two mouth swabs, and then they did anal swab, and they did a vaginal swab. Vaginal swab isn't what they got the match on. It was at her mouth. So, you know, then one of the things that Maude Cruz, who was his attorney, was trying to argue was like, look, they were trying to bring in consent at some point. And I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like, so wait, they were going to argue that there was something consensual happened between them? Because the other part of this that's really fucked up is that her boyfriend, who they had broken up with, this guy, Chris Melton, I think his name is, they found his DNA in her anal swab. And they had not been together, depending on who you ask, between 7 and 10 days. Okay?
Okay.
So, you know, that was a big bone of contention there in terms of why is his DNA inside of her 7 days later? There was this bizarre theory that the state had that, like, I forget what she termed it. Somebody in the chat probably knows, it dripped back in there, or was an anal drip. It was something bizarre, like that. The semen had gone back. It was the weirdest thing I'd ever heard of. At the end of the day, there's no physical evidence that the guy was actually in the house. And I'm talking about Faust. Okay. Like, they just couldn't prove it. You know, his stepmother lived in that area. And frankly, their house was like 585 feet away from Tara Baker's back door, same neighborhood. And the state used that as a smoking gun, you know, trying to make it sound like he just popped in there and that he wasn't living there full time, when that's not the facts. The fact is he was staying there. He was living there. He was in that neighborhood, and he would ride his bike around all the time. You know, I mean, that's where he was staying at that point. And, you know, they put on a couple of witnesses that are like, oh, I saw a black guy. like literally that, like not that black guy per se, but I saw a black guy walk by my house on the morning of, and, you know, it could have been him, but it was a black, like, everything aside from the DNA was ridiculous. Like, every part of the case was ridiculous. The DNA thing, the problem with that, again, is that true allele thing. And the bigger issue for me, you know, because Faust his attorney Cruz was just getting hammered by this judge. So everybody hated Lott, rightfully so. And everyone was feeling certain ways for Ahmaud Cruz, the defense attorney, because she was so abusive to him. You know, like she was just like riding him like a rented mule. It was crazy. So everybody, you know, and I'm not one to really, I try not to be critical if it's not warranted. And I thought that he tried the case as best as he could, you know, but I had a real problem going into the defense's case in chief with the fact that they elected not to put on their own expert to try to challenge the true allele in any way that they could. They had to give the jury something to be able to hang their hat on,
right,
in opposite of true allele, and they didn't. So you're stuck with this jury having this number of 1 in 800 quadrillion that it was Faust, and they didn't really put on a defense at all. You know, so as a matter of fact, I think they just rested. Like I don't think they put on a defense at all. So I was, and they deliberated 11 hours.
It's surprising, actually, that they went that long. Yeah, so like, I didn't follow the case. I've just been reading about it. It seems like there were some issues with the trial and the rulings, but as far as like innocent, it's always interesting to me when I see so many people saying that this guy's innocent, and I'm, without knowing anything about the case, just knowing the facts like that I've read and what you've explained, it's like there's probably issues with this true allele, but what are the odds that the algorithm comes up with a profile, it goes into a national database with millions of profiles in it and finds a profile for a guy that lived right there?
Yeah, I mean, it's problematic. I mean, but when you think about the area, is there anywhere that they could have crossed paths? Is there, or, you know, because if they got it...
Well, that's what I was looking for, was there, did they put up a defense saying, well, no, of course his DNA's on there, they dated, or they did this, or I didn't read anything like that where they gave any, like, reason why his DNA would be there, or right, that they challenged the validity of it.
The same bar, and there was, like, a bowl of, you know, peanuts on the fucking bar, and each one had stuck their hand in it. Like, because it was, they right. got the sample from her mouth, that particular, that's what they developed the profile from. So, I mean, no, they didn't. They didn't address, but like I said, he was denied from bringing in consent defense. So there were certain, like, I think he's going to get another trial. I really do. Mm-hmm. And I think that his thinking might have been, which is a dangerous gambit, that she had made so many mistakes, I'm talking about the judge, on pretrial rulings, that Cruz felt like, I'm not going to put on a defense that might fuck up all the mistakes and cure the mistakes that this judge has made in pretrial rulings, where the court is like, oh, well, you know, you put on a defense, so we think that was harmless error. You know, they heard what you had to say, and they still came back with a guilty. You know what I'm saying? That's a dangerous way to approach it. But if he was adamant about the fact that there were just so many Sixth Amendment type violations in terms of him getting a fair trial, it might have been his mindset that, like, look, we're just going to call it. You know, I don't think that they've proven their case. You know, I just knew that the true allele was going to be the death knell for them. You know, it's like that no one is fine. People want to convict in those courtrooms. I mean, if you were at that table, the likelihood is very high that you're getting convicted. It's very rare to walk away with not guilty in cases. It just is. Yeah. You know, I mean,
and I wonder if they had evidence, if I'm understanding right, the judge wouldn't allow them to put in a consent defense. So perhaps they had evidence that they could present to, like we were, you know, the pretzels at the bar or consensual sex or something like that. That maybe they did have evidence, but since the judge wouldn't allow it, that's why we didn't get an explanation for it. Did I understand that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, kind of. I mean, like, and I see in chat, there were mislabeled samples and, you know, but to me, like, I've had that happen in plenty of trials where, you know, the chain of custody is not great. But at the end of the day, unless I have somebody that can prove from my side, from the defense side, that there was cross-contamination, it's still, even if they're mislabeled, I need to show where they, like, somebody in the lab was working on one case and somehow if it is in fact Faust's DNA, how it got cross-contaminated into to the area where, you know, the particular lab tech that was working on her case was. And it had to have been, the timing had to have been the same. You know what I'm saying? It's like, like we're talking 23 years ago, and whenever they're developing that profile back in the lab, you'd have to be able to say, all right, well, you know, Faust, and he was just arrested like 2 days prior, like either 2 days prior or after the homicide took place. So theoretically, I mean, it's possible, but again, that wasn't brought out in court in terms of the possibility that there was cross-contamination in the lab. Look, I don't know enough about the defense because there wasn't really one put forth in terms of how you're going to deal with that DNA problem. But it's going to be one of the bigger things that's going to get dealt with on appeal, that's for sure, you know? And, you know, but you know how it is, Bob. Like, once you get sucked into the system, man, it is like moving mountains to get out, you know? And it's like, I'm not as quick as some to just screaming from the rooftops that somebody's innocent and factually innocent. You know, because it really, when you do that, it devalues what you have to say about cases that you do feel very strongly about, you know, and it, like, that's why I'm not so quick to do that on every case. Here, I absolutely believe that his Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial was violated. I'm not willing to say at this point because I don't have enough information that I think that he's factually innocent. That doesn't mean that I don't think that he could be. Absolutely, I do. But like, I'm not in the business of guessing, you know, like for me, I'm adamant about Richard Allen because I know a fuck ton about that case. And I know the people involved in that case. I've spoken with Allen's family at length. I've looked at what the evidence is in that case. And that fucking guy didn't do that. That guy got railroaded and I'll die on that hill. And I will, you know, it's like, I want justice for those two girls, just like everybody else. Don't kill the messenger here. You know, they wanted to get somebody convicted on that thing and they got a patsy. And I know that you've had Andrea on, I know you've had Osbrook on. And like, when you're talking to a bunch of attorneys that are pretty bright and aren't jumping all over, you know, every case saying this person's innocent, none of us do that. And when every lawyer that I talk to, lawyers from Indiana, every lawyer that I spoke to that has looked into that case has been like, it's no good. it's not a good conviction. So you want to feel secure in convictions, you know what I mean? And it's like that case is, so I don't know, that's kind of where I'm at with the Faust thing. I do hope that he gets a new trial. He does deserve it. And I hope that at that new trial, we get more information. You know, I really do. Cause I think in order to get there, in order for any jury to ever find him not guilty, they're going to have to explain the DNA thing.
Yeah, for sure.
And chain of custody shit's not it. Like no jury is ever going to find somebody not guilty cause some fuck ups in chain of custody. They're just not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I imagine you're going to have to show a jury, like the concern that popped into my mind. You have to show them how did this, however the algorithm or however the testing was done, go into a database with millions of people across the whole country. How did it land on a guy that happened to, one, have a record for other violent assaults from what I was reading and lived right there in that neighborhood? Like that's a hard, but like you said, that, you know, our job is to make sure that everybody is getting a fair trial and the Constitution's working prop. So like, for me, it sounds like if the conviction gets overturned and they retry him and they retry him properly and convict him again, and we can be more confident in the conviction, then that's just as much of a win, I think.
Agreed. You know, I mean, that's where we need to land on these cases. I mean, if it's circumstantial evidence, I mean, you want to walk away from it feeling confident as you can in the conviction. You know what I mean? And it's like, so you have to have the fair trial part of it. Like that's just a given. You can't be, you just can never feel secure in any conviction if it wasn't done on the up and up. So, you know, and like the Chris Melton thing is problematic for me. You know, I mean, the boyfriend thing with the anal swab and his DNA being present there when it had really no business being there 7 to 10 days later. is a fucking problem. You know what I mean? Like, that's
right.
That's a thing. And they could not put on the third party culprit defense. Like, she barred that. Like, there's things about the case that are very troublesome. Like, let me put it that way. You know, I don't want people getting all upset at me about, like, oh, he's innocent. Well, you know, maybe he is. And I would like to see a lot more exploration of the Chris Melton side of this, because I was really not at all satisfied with what came in and the lack of third party culprit stuff that did not come in, you know, because they were just living on this guy's alibi, you know. Mm-hmm. But I kept saying during the trial, I'm like, why are we assuming that this actually took place in the morning as opposed to overnight, and that somebody came back to the house and set it on fire in the morning? Like, why are we assuming that the two things happened at the same time? Like, it could very easily have been that the assault and homicide takes place overnight, early morning hours, and then the killer comes back after they're like, well, man, I got to go fucking do something about this crime scene, and tries to set the house on fire. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, those...
It seems likely even. I mean...
It seems very likely.
But it's not like TV where these people that commit these crimes always have this like devious plan, and usually something happens that they didn't plan on happening. They freak out, then they think it through, and then they're like, well, shit, now what we do? Now what do I do to cover my tracks? Like, it makes total sense they would then come back and try to light the place on fire.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I mean, the Chris Melton thing, like, we'll kind of wrap it with this. As far as I'm concerned, you know, because his testimony, and they put him on the stand, he testified. And the thing that's most problematic with him for me, that really kind of makes me think maybe this guy did it, was, again, that timeline issue. I don't buy his alibi. I don't think that's an actual alibi, because they couldn't establish when the time of death was, as they can't in most cases in terms of to the minute or to the hour. But that he had claimed that they had never had anal sex, that she wouldn't allow for it to happen. So for his semen to be found in her anus is really, really problematic. And it would seem to be kind of indicative of maybe a sexual assault type situation. If it was known that they had never had anal sex, that she didn't like it, wasn't something that they did, how do you explain? Like, and I think that that's what they were saying, that their theory was that the semen had dripped down from the vagina into the anus is what they were, how they were trying to
a week earlier.
Right. So I don't know, man.
I mean,
there's some disturbing facts, you know, that would certainly require, I think, a real deep dive into Melton and that potential third party culprit stuff. But again, it still doesn't explain why the hell Faust DNA is there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know. It's
an interesting one. I may, who was it that covered it in depth?
Kat Not Williams. She covered the whole, that's her channel. K-A-T-T, Not Williams.
I have to get with you after the show. Maybe I'll connect with her sometime and have her,
she's
come
great.
On and talk a little more about it.
Yeah, and I mean, Kat's more of the mindset that Edric's not guilty, you know, and she's a really bright gal. She's not an attorney, but she's super, super intuitive, and she has a very firm grasp of the criminal justice system. So, you know,
great.
Like I said, she has a real knack for finding cases that always interest me. So, and I consider her to be a really bright person. So, yeah, she'd be a good guest for sure.
Great. Yeah, we'll put her on the list. All right. So, I want to move on to talk about, just real quick, so we can get into, because you wanted to talk about Barton McNeil's case a little bit. Just up, you know, we had you and Lauren on way back when you guys first started Murder on Songbird Lane podcast.
Yeah.
With the Julia Beverly conviction in that case. And I remember when we first talked, I was only a couple episodes in. You'd only released a couple episodes at that point. And I was like, oh, I'm curious to see how you guys turn this thing around. And, you know, when I finished the podcast, it was a while ago, you did. For me, I mean, it seems, you know, just I just wrote myself a couple notes of some of the things that, you know, that I noted that you guys found in that case is that, you know, there was the lack of any, you know, such a bloody scene. There was a complete lack of forensic evidence on Julia. the case narrowed onto Julia way too quickly, and it seemed like the cops had blinders on.
Yeah.
There were several indications of possible other suspects and evidence that pointed away from Julia that wasn't addressed at trial. And then the big one was, you know, the big kind of linchpin seemed like kind of the state's case was that Huck's gas station footage of her pulling in and putting something in the trash. But then you guys kind of attacked that timeline. And that, to me, that was the part that really, really kind of broke things apart. So just what, you know, where does the case stand now? Where do you stand on it? And where does Murder on Songbird Lane podcast stand?
So it's Road, by the way, Bob. Murder on Songbird Road. So we are doing a second season. Actually, Lauren and I were just down in Marion 2 weekends ago. Direct appeal was filed. It was fully briefed and it was denied. So they affirmed the conviction. And Flom had helped her, Julia, she hired Zellner's office to do the appeal. I don't think Kathleen ended up actually being the one to do it. Her office had done it. And they really just kind of focused on, I didn't have much hope for the appeal after I had read the briefs.
Yeah.
After I had listened to oral arguments, I was like, okay, this is going to be a post-conviction thing. And I always thought it was going to be a post-conviction case anyway. In a case like that, I'm always of the mindset, we're going to have to find out who the hell did this. You know,
yeah.
That's just where I live in that case. So ultimately, iHeart did re-up for a second season, so we're going to get that done. On the positive side of it, both the Illinois Innocence Project and Exoneration Project are both involved and are representing her moving forward for the post-conviction stuff. So that's big. And you know how they vet the cases.
Yeah.
They're not jumping in on some bullshit. So we're very optimistic about that. And, you know, we spent some more time, like I said, a couple of weekends ago down there talking to more people. You know, we're digging. It's clear that in Marion County, there's a lot of corruption, which, you know, you do this over the years, you start to realize a lot of these small towns, you know, you like to think that there's not corruption going on, but I'd say more often than not, there's some level of corruption going on in these small town departments. And in Marion, you have the concept of the fact that Julie is mixed race. Her stepfather who had raised her was one of only two black men ever hired as a sheriff down there, ever. You know, and he had ran for sheriff and ended up losing. And there's just a lot of dynamics of that case, which we're still really digging into. And the meth problem down there is rampant still. And both Lauren and I really believe that this thing lives somewhere in the meth world, that somebody was sitting on that house that morning and they were surprised that anybody was there. You know, they thought that when Julie pulled away that the house was empty. And then when they got into that house, probably to just rob it, you know, to get some money to score their next hit. You know, they were surprised by Jade being in there and the thing just got crazy fast, you know. So, but at the end of the day, we're going to have to prove it, I think. You know,
yeah.
I don't know if you, when I ended up interviewing, I walked up to the house next door. And the people that had bought that property ended up closing, I think, 2 days after the arrest of Julie Beverly. I was disappointed because I had gone over there to see if they had heard or seen anything. And then while we're standing there and I'm having the conversation, I'm like, well, did you hear about the case? And the husband was like, yeah, I heard about the case. I'm like, well, what did you hear? He's like, yeah, I kept hearing that it had something to do with meth. I was like, oh, no shit. Interesting. I'm like, who'd you hear that from? He's like, yeah, just various people. So then I hear his wife like yelling from inside the house. It's like, tell him about the guy who came onto the porch like 3 weeks, 4 weeks later. So I'm like, so the wife comes up. I'm like, you know, introduce myself. I'm like, tell me about this. What happened? She's like, it's like, it was like maybe early February. So it might've been five weeks, maybe even 6 weeks later. It's like early morning. Some dude, some shirtless guy in February is on their porch, like knocking on the door and they had a Ring video for it, a Ring camera video for it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, is there any way you still have that video? So she like goes back. She's like, I might. So she like, well, we're sitting there. I waved to Lauren to come out of the rental. I'm like, come up here. I'm like, hey, can we start recording this? So then she ends up giving us, she finds the Ring video, and this is fucking guy standing up there shirtless, looks to be kind of well-built, and he speaks in this almost like Shakespeare in the Park thespian type, like he's got this intonation. He's like, I have not been here but for 30 years, and it's the weirdest fucking thing of all time. Uh-huh. And he's banging on the door. He's like, please, please, I need to speak to you. I come in peace. I mean no harm. You know, it was the weirdest shit. So then we become obsessed because we had always said, like, this area is not a place where you're going to get foot traffic. Like, this is...
Yeah, because it was down Songbird Road, not Lane, was down the...
Right.
So there was no other houses around, right? It was way down the road.
Right. I mean, like, well, so I'd say there's like 100, 150 yards between the houses. So this is in like a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere. You probably had about 6 to 8 houses, but like the little house I was at was literally 75 yards away from where their place was, you know? So, I mean, it was, you know, spitting distance. And same with the neighbor to the right. And you know, and that neighbor, he's my white elephant, man. Like, he's the guy that I just keep chasing, because the word on the street, because if you're familiar with the case, Julie, when she called 911, had always claimed that a person all clad in black wearing a ski mask was coming out of the house as she was walking in, and he had a knife in his hand. They got into a hand fight, and which, you know, is how she claims that she has these injuries, which the state obviously took as defensive wounds, you know, as there was some kind of battle going on while she was killing Jade. That was always their theory.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Julie had always claimed that this guy, just after they got in this hand fight and she went back, ran back to go get Michael, you know, the man that she was living with, Jade's father's gun, which was in the bedstand, and that she came back and, like, at that point she wasn't even thinking about Jade, and she's like, you know what, and she doesn't see which way the guy goes. So we started hearing rumors that there were 2 911 calls, and that one of them had come from the neighbor, if you're facing the house to the right, and this guy's name is Butch, and that Butch had said that he had called 911 and said that somebody in all black had just run through his backyard at around the same time that this is all taking place. I'm like, what? So I'm trying to get this guy to talk to me. You know, I'm like, and his sister is this gatekeeper who, like, both times I've gone up to the house, she's, you know, she stands up there.
He still lives there?
He does. Well, his sisters live in the house. He lives in this kind of like shed in the back. And the first time I went out there, he was back there with a chainsaw cutting trees up. So I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to walk back there. I'm going to walk up to the house and see if I can get one of the sisters to go get him, to see if I could talk to him real quick. I should have come with a 12-pack in hand. That probably would have got him to engage with me. Because I just want to ask him, did you make the call? Did you make that 911 call? Because we can't find it.
Yeah.
We can't find the call. And Lauren really tried. You know, and the problem was out in that area, you can get patched to several different places. And, you know, so that when we tried to FOIA it, we just couldn't find this 911 call, but people were insistent that it had taken place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a guy that I really want to have the conversation with, because that is exculpatory evidence. If there's a person that can substantiate that somebody in fact was running from Julia's house through his backyard, you know, to get onto this other road while they're escaping. Plus, they didn't drag the 2 ponds. They didn't even try to find the murder weapon.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of stuff coming up in season 2, which we found out after the fact because we were unable to get our hands on the police reports. And like you, Bob, I live in those. I need the case.
Right.
I have to be able to dig into those to see what's what. So some of the things that we ended up discovering in the discovery, when we got our hands on some of it, was shocking. It was shocking. And one of the main things is that we found 2 police reports where they talk about this clump of hair in Jade's hand. And I'm like, holy shit. I'm like, what? And they never tested it. And Julie Beverly is mixed race. And you could bet your ass that this is, like, her hair is very thick and it, you know, and it's long and it's black. And if it was Julie's hair, that would have been Exhibit A.
For sure, yeah.
In chief. And so that tells me that it wasn't. Could it have been Jade's own hair? Maybe. Test it. Let's find it. Let's find out who it is and rule it out. If it's another person's hair, I don't know if it was long. I don't know if it was short. I don't know what it was. You know what I'm saying? But, or does it match this one hair that they found on the doorknob leading out, you know, which was not tested. It's a case that there's, again, the investigation was shoddy, and shoddy investigations always lead to problems, you know?
Yeah. So, and it seems like another example of, we see it all the time where they don't want to find bad evidence. So things go untested.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So before I let you go rake those leaves, you said you wanted to talk. Now, Barton McNeil's case, there was a guy that was doing a podcast about his case years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe 10 years. I don't know. It was a long time ago, who asked me to read into the case and come on and be a guest on his show. And I did. I read into everything he gave me. And it went on to a show, and I was like, at that point, I was like, man, if this case was pitched to me, I would turn it down. It looks like he's guilty to me.
Yeah.
And so that was the end of it. And I don't remember a lot of the details about it. It was his daughter, right? Was murdered.
Daughter.
Yeah. In the bedroom. And I remember there was a deal with like the screen or the window or in the blinds. I remember bits about it. And for you guys saying I was unprepared, Bob told me literally right before we went live that I want to talk about Bard McNeil. So it's like, oh shit, let me see. What do I remember?
Don't make me go to the text messages. Wait a second. I'm going to the text.
Already had a text. Oh, yes. Let's go to the text. We already had an issue about the date. You mentioned Bard McNeil, but I thought we landed on Songbird.
I'm going to the text. You said, we talked about Faust a little bit. Mm-hmm. Oh, you said, hey, let's get out. We talked about wanting to come on. I said, there's two wrongful conviction cases I'm covering. One is Beverly, which obviously you knew. And then the other one, also the Barton McNeil case, who's been in for 27 years. It's a crazy case. And you said, so you had already established you wanted to talk about Faust. So you said, I had you on to talk about Songbird Lane right after it launched. We can catch up on that one. Oh, so you're right again. God damn it. It says, if we have time, we can touch on the Barton McNeil case. Son, I'm doing what Allison does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You guys should know, a little, you know, behind the curtain too, Bob did also put out a tweet yesterday saying that I was going to be on a show on the 14th, and I had to correct him on that one too. So yeah, I'm telling Allison that you did not fully read.
No, it's like I'm blazing through these text messages.
Tell me what you're doing with McNeil's case. Because like I said, you know, it's not like I spent years looking into it.
Yeah.
You know, I was given some materials. You know, I was able to spend a week with it, looked into it, and I was like, man, I don't see it. If this is what somebody gave me in a case submission and I screened it, I would deny it.
Yeah. So I got more. So back in the days when I used to go to CrimeCon and attend over there, which I don't anymore, but I had Bart McNeil's cousin, this guy, Chris Ross, come up to our table, and he's like, oh man, he's like, I've listened to your stuff. I really want you to look into this. I'm like, yeah, man, hit me up. You know, so he did. He followed up, and he was relentless, and he sent me everything. And so I started digging into it, you know, and I had everything. I had the 911 call, which was where I started, you know, because the way that it went down with that case, and I'll try to thumbnail this thing or, you know, make a real Cliff Notes version of it. You know, when they originally got to the scene, they had initially ruled that it was a natural death, that she had suffered an asthma attack while she was sleeping, mm-hmm. because they saw no signs of any kind of foul play at all. And so Bart is the one who calls them back. He discovers that the fan that he had sitting in the room, to like a box fan, had been knocked over, and then he sees these two little cuts in the screen. So he calls them back, like begging them to send a homicide detective back.
Yeah.
So the significance of it was that the woman that he had been dating, this Masook Nolens, they had broken up like within the last 10 days. And that evening they had gone out to dinner. She had a case, an open case, criminal case, where he was the victim that was due in court 2 days later. And she had been trying to convince him to come in and testify and say that, you know, basically change his story. And so they end up getting into an argument in the restaurant, and she's super pissed off and upset. And so, like, it becomes his obsession that he thinks that Masuk came in during the night and strangled his daughter or suffocated his daughter with a pillow. And ultimately, you know, in that, when they bring him in, and there was this initial ruling that there was, the medical examiner said that he thought that the child had been sexually abused. So once ME comes back with that, they then pivot to dad, you know, so you can see the turn happen, like during the second interview of Bart, where they had the ME say that to him. In the interim, just so you understand, that there's been multiple expert forensic pathologists who've reviewed the same evidence, and they've reached the opposite conclusion, that there was no evidence of sexual abuse at all. So if you kind of like fast forward, you know, so he gets convicted, and then fast forward to 2011. Well, before you get to 2011, the other significant thing is 2 months after Bart McNeil's arrested, Masuk Nolan is charged with smothering her own daughter. And she ends up convicted of it. And she gets sentenced to 150 days in jail for the abuse of her own child. And then fast forward to 2011, she is convicted for strangling her mother-in-law and killing her. And she's currently in prison for that. And that was based on the fact that the husband was ending the marriage. So you've got like kind of the same factual scenario with a woman who is clearly homicidal, and they just have not had any luck convincing the appellate courts or any post-conviction court to give them a new trial. So, I mean, at this point, I think they have one shot left, but like I have come to the conclusion, I do not think that Bart did this. I honestly don't. I think that Masuk did do it. I think that she came there and did this thing because I think that she's that person. I just do. I mean, like to have those kind of smoking gun types of things occurring after the fact are a bit too coincidental for me, you know? So, you know, and there's just no evidence that he was abusing his child. There's no evidence as to why he would have killed her. You know, they also found Masuk's, one of her hairs on the sheets, which at trial didn't come in because they said that, well, if it did, I think it did end up coming in, but the state said, well, you know, that was his former girlfriend. You know, her hair could very easily have been in the bed, but he had evidence that he had just laundered the sheets before his daughter was coming for visitation.
Yeah.
So the sheets were clean. So there would be no excuse as to why her hair would continue to be in that bed. So there's just a lot there that when you're kind of like looking at it, it's hard for me not to come to the conclusion that Masuk, and you have multiple confessions from Masuk where she's claimed that she killed her to an ex-husband.
I wish I remembered what there was, and maybe you could. I just remember that I was like, no, I think he did it. And like, obviously the way you just described it, I'm like, well, that doesn't seem likely, but there was reasons back then, 10 years ago, whatever it was. I mean,
the only thing it could have been was the food. Like they tried to land on a time of death by the fact that he had gotten her a Happy Meal. And in terms of the amount of food that had been digested and where it was at in terms of the digestion process, they had landed on the fact of like this time that the child was killed, which they had closer to midnight as opposed to any other time during the night. And that's just some junk science, man. Like you cannot pinpoint a time of death based on that kind of evidence, because they didn't really, you know, but that had to have been it, because like that was really the only thing that
wasn't there. I feel like there was something with the window that,
oh, it was like
made it seem staged to me.
Spider webs, the cobwebs in the corners.
That's what it was. Maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, they were saying that the cobwebs or the spider webs in the corners made it so that there's no way that those corners would have been, you know, the little corners of the screen would be cut out and the screen lifted up without those webs being disturbed. They still wouldn't act. But, they've gotten experts to say, well, that's simply not a fact. Guy's been in for 27 years on spider webs. I don't know.
Yeah, that might have been what did it. And maybe, in my cursory glance.
Things that kind of exist, like the spider web thing and the Happy Meal thing, really.
Yeah, I don't remember the Happy Meal thing, but I remember the spy. I remember looking at the crime scene photos he had sent to me or whatever, and being and the stuff in the police report is well, if he's saying somebody just broke into that window, why are there cobwebs in the, in the corners of it or something? But so what are you going to be? Are you going to be covering this on Defense Diaries? Are you doing another podcast on it? What are you doing about it?
I think I'm going to do a season on it. I think I'm going to do it because I went down to Illinois State a couple weeks ago. They had an event. A BART event down there, and I spoke down there, and there was a couple of lawyers from the Innocence Project down there, and it was a pretty solid event. And and people that are familiar with the Jamie Snow case, because that one has gotten a lot more publicity than BART's, but it's the same prosecutor's office, same cops, that are investigating those two crimes and prosecuting them. So and there's a lot of problems with that office. So I just think it's worth my time. I feel pretty comfortable in saying, and I'd love to have a conversation with Masuk, if at all possible.
Right.
No, I just want to ask her some questions, I really do. And she's in for 55 years. She's going to be in there for good. And there's no doubt that she did that. They nailed her on that. So I think that it's going to be, one of those cases where I don't know if he'll ever get out. I don't, but I feel like it deserves some more light shined upon it. So I think I'm going to, dig into it. And I am 100%, I'm actually recording a Garcia episode today. I'm in the last five episodes of that season, which has been just epically long, the bane of my existence. It's like I'm on episode 72 of that season. It's insane. It's insane. It's an absolutely insane. It's like Josh Hallmark territory with his
Israel Key stuff.
Yeah, his Israel Key stuff. It's just like the thing that never ends. But I'm close on it. All right. And the last thing I'm gonna say, Aaron Spencer, you gotta look into it. I'm gonna be covering it boots on the ground because it's not streaming. Basically what it is, his 13-year-old daughter was groomed by this 67-year-old creep who unwittingly to them, he had met the child at a mutual friend's house. They were friends with the creep, and I'm talking about the mutual friends, and the Spencer family was friends with the mutual friends. So they would send her over to their house to hang out, and this guy groomed her in a way that people that truly understand grooming will understand. It was significant. He significantly groomed her. Ultimately, he sexually assaults her. Ultimately, she makes an outcry. Ultimately, he's arrested and charged with 43 felony counts. He gets a $5,000 bond. It was 50, but 10% to apply. So he posts $5,000. He's out for 3 months. He reengages with her in terms of starts communicating, even though there's a stay away order not to contact any child. It was initially on the case was awful. And there's some debate on whether or not she's the same judge who gave Fossler, the guy who committed the assaults, whether she gave him that bond or if it was a different judge that was handling the bond call that morning. But at any rate, she got booted from the case. So long story short, 12:30 at night, Chihuahua's barking, wakes Aaron up, goes into the kid's room. At first glance, he thinks she's in there, sees that the blanket is pulled up. He pulls the blanket down, sees it's a teddy bear stuffed into a hoodie. He's like, call 911. He's like, I'm going to go out and try to find her. So she's on the phone with 911. They have a gate, like many properties down in Arkansas do, to get onto the property. She opens the gate. She's on 911 and he takes off. He's going down the road, which they live on, which I think is Route 236. And he's gone a couple miles down and he sees Fossler's truck pulling onto his road, and it's a state highway, and he sees his daughter in the truck. So he proceeds to chase him for 6 miles. He's flashing his lights, honking the horn, ultimately does a pit maneuver, which he's been trained to do. So he gets them off the road safely, and he's out of his vehicle and he's screaming for his daughter to get out of his truck. The daughter's not getting out of the truck. Screaming continues. ultimately Fossler himself gets out. He's screaming and yelling, and he starts charging at Spencer. Spencer thinks he has something in his hand, puts 15 rounds into him, then goes, because he to check if he's dead, he's still breathing, so he pistol whips him, immediately calls 911, says, "I just killed this guy. He had my daughter." And they ultimately charge him with second-degree murder. He's standing trial on June 22nd is when it started. It's unbelievable. It's an unbelievable story. So
you're going to be boots on the ground on that one?
Yeah, I'm going to be boots on the ground on that one. And I'm very much pro Aaron Spencer in that case.
Yeah. So we'll definitely have you back again. Everybody loves the talk with the Bobs. So I want to talk about that when you get start working on Spencer, when you launch your season on Barton McNeil, all kinds of cool stuff. Bob, I appreciate you coming on. It's always awesome to catch up.
Awesome.
And by the way, if you're a patron and you're listening to this audio, if you go watch the video version on Patreon, there's about a 20-minute pregame chat with me and Bob on there that you won't get on the audio, but you can get on the video. So check that out. Also, make sure you tune in to the Defense Diary channel this Tuesday in 2 days at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Central Time. I'm going to be on Defense Diaries talking about the Bynum case. Bob's been great catching up, and we'll see you again on the 21st.
Love to be here, Bob.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.